Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Interview with Bob Brown.
I'm interviewing Mike Halligan in Missoula, Montana on, I believe it's July 28th, 2009. Mike served in the State Senate from, I believe, by appointment in 1980 until 2000.
That was actually, you turned out by 2002, so you have your, I mean, okay. 2001 was my last session.
So 22 years.
Yep.
22 years. Mike, what caused you to become involved in public service? What caused you to devote much of your life's career to public service?
Well, my family was not involved in politics at all, and I did not pay much attention in high school. As a result of that, I ended up in Vietnam. And it was in Vietnam, and listening to the discussions of my men, I was a platoon leader from the inner cities of Detroit and Chicago and New York, and for the first time discovered a lot of the social, the political, the economic upheaval that was going on at the time that I really hadn't paid much attention to. And so it was that Vietnam era upheaval of society in general that kind of got my attention. And I realized then that politicians can kill. You know, I mean, it was this leap that Congress had adopted laws that took men and women into places that would get them killed. And I determined then, after again listening to a lot of discussion, political discussion around the Hooches, that I wanted to go into politics someday and that I could make a difference that way, but I had to go to school to be able to do it. So it was the kind of the 60s, the late 60s, with the social, economic, and political upheaval, and then actually being in Vietnam, realizing politicians can make a difference, can kill, and that I needed to potentially get involved in some way.
Some of the men who served in Vietnam, and I know you were a lieutenant, you were a platoon commander, you were involved in combat, came home feeling resentful toward the people who were demonstrating against the Vietnam War in the United States. Others came home perhaps somewhat disillusioned by the Vietnam War and were actually protesters themselves. Where would you fit in on that spectrum?
Well, when I got back, I was shocked at how resentful people were when you said you were in the military. I mean, it was a visceral reaction by much of the public. And when I went to school at the University of Montana in September of 71, and I had gotten out in April at the Sigma Chi fraternity house where I was living, I mean, you didn't mention that you were in the military. It was something that was a negative thing, because all the Mylai incidences and yeah. the other scandals of killings had come out into the public, and so really, my military experience, even though it shaped me individually, I didn't become resentful. I just was shocked by the experience that I received from the public. But it also helped shape me my understanding of the reaction that they gave me, that I needed to have a broader understanding of people's backgrounds and not judge them by one particular thing. So I think it helped me in that regard.
Was the Vietnam experience what you think may have triggered your entry into running for elective office?
I do think, yeah, the Vietnam experience was, because there was nothing else in my background that would have shaped me enough, other than that triggering event of being there in a situation with, and particularly listening to the political discussions of people who had gone to college, who were more heavily involved and paid attention. That got my attention as well.
Then you returned home from Vietnam in 71.
Yes.
But then you sought office. Didn't you run for the Public Service Commission?
I didn't run for the Public Service Commission until 1980. Actually, in the 79-80 election. So it was not till 9 years later. So I worked on, you know, all the political campaigns of legislators, Mike Mansfield's last campaign, I believe, just, again, knocking on doors and that sort of thing. So my political involvement, I ran for the city, a partisan job, a study commission, and they elected 7 out of 9. It was back after the Constitutional Convention adopted that provision, and I came in number 9th out of 7 as a graduate student. So it was my first elected position I lost, but that was my first involvement in actually running for office. It was in 1970. what year would it have been? 77, I believe.
Could you describe your political philosophy? What shaped it? I mean, I know the Vietnam War was important in triggering your involvement into politics, but you, along the way, adopted a philosophy of some kind. Tell about that.
Well, and I think as I ran for office, I mean, I was a moderate from the beginning. I was never a person that held extreme positions or that wasn't a good listener. And when I first got to the legislature, we were in the minority. And I sat in the back of the Senate, not by my own choosing. That was one of the last seats because I was a freshman. And sitting with some of the old bulls who'd been there for 20-plus years, Carol Graham, moderate senator from Lodge Grass, Paul Boylan, moderate senator from Bozeman, and others, they were the ones that maybe they didn't know what they were doing, but they shaped a lot of my philosophy by just simply saying, Halligan, you know, you may be reelected here for the next 20 or 30 years, but if you don't work with the guys on the other side of the aisle, you're never going to get a damn thing done. And it was just listening to those guys and then watching the way that when the Senate got into session, the old bulls would stand up and start roaming around, and that's what they would when they would work their magic. And these guys knew how to compromise, they knew how to, you know, make deals that would make good public policy, and they knew how to, you know, in a time when the legislature was in session, when the Senate was there, no lobbyists were around, be able to actually go individually talk to somebody. And I guess I watched that kind of conduct, and it kind of shaped my way of that you don't do things by standing up on the floor and ranting and raving. You get your work done by talking to people, by communicating, by trying to see what interests them and see if there's a compromise you could come to.
You were elected as a Democrat.
Yes.
And you served as the minority leader, the Democratic leader in the state Senate, I believe, for two terms.
Right.
So and of course Missoula then had, there was an advantage in running as a Democrat. I'm not presuming anything, but why are you a Democrat?
Well, I think...
Was your family that way?
My Catholic family,
I see.
Yeah, out of Billings, or John F. Kennedy was the first to my exposure to politics. And I actually rode my bike from Lewis and Clark Middle School then. It was the freshman in junior high. I rode all the way to the fairgrounds by myself. Have no idea to this day why I did that, because my family was not involved in politics, but we were involved because the Catholics were heavily involved in that election, just to listen to John F. Kennedy when he came to Billings, and I remember that vividly. But my parents weren't overly political at all. They never talked politics beyond the John F. Kennedy election, but I think as a Democrat, as I look more at the values that the Democrats stood for in terms of more the common man's issues and issues of freedom of choice when it comes to the right of privacy and those kinds of things, that I fit more into that category than on the Republican side.
So you arrived in the legislature, newly elected member after the 1980 election, and you'd mentioned that you were seated in the back row with the old bulls, the old moderate to conservative Democrats. So I already know those are part of your early impressions in the legislature. Just describe, though you might have been over there, maybe you'd been over there a time or two before, but just describe what it was like to be in the legislature then.
You know,
what were your first impressions?
My first impressions were that this is a good old boys club. That even though I was 32, so I wasn't a young man when I was elected, but that it was a collegial place, that it was a place where friendships really meant a lot, and that just the partisan bickering side that I didn't really know, until I saw it later on during my career, you didn't hardly see it. There were differences of opinion, and they were well stated on the floor of the Senate, but mostly, I mean, people saw each other during the day. They went out to dinner, and they were friends beyond their legislative differences. And I think that, more than anything else, was my earliest impression, was that, you know, maybe the public was seeing something that was the different sides not voting together, and they saw the disagreements on TV or in the newspaper, but that's not the way the process worked in real life.
It was pretty fraternal and pretty
definitely
easygoing and that sort of thing. Yes. Did that change in the 22 years in which you served there?
It absolutely changed. And I think with term limits passing in 1992, that was one of the most devastating effects on statesmanship, on collegiality, on long-term vision, on the fraternal aspects of it. I mean, people just weren't elected after that with any long-term vision. There were short-term agendas. There were people who were there for one issue or two issues, and that just doesn't make for a legislative process that's designed to be deliberative and look at the long term rather than the short term.
In addition to Boylan and Graham, are there legislators that particularly stand out in your memory?
You know, I'll tell this story about myself, and one of my first experiences in deciding how I should vote on an issue that was very important to me, and that was a flag burning amendment that the veterans were supporting to criminalize the burning of the flag. And of course, I'm a veteran, so I was very interested in making sure I was sensitive to veterans' issues, and I was prepared to vote for that bill on second reading when Chet Blalock, who had been in the legislature, I think, at least 10 or 12 or 15 years by then in 1981 when I first got there, stood up, and he was considered to be the conscience of the Senate. I think that was his tag. And he gave the most impassioned plea for the First Amendment and why and how important the flag was to us, but how important the symbol it was in a way that burning the flag was not the issue, that it was what was inside of us. And I mean, this impassioned plea that literally changed my vote, because here was this statesman telling me really that freedoms in this country meant more than the cloth, it meant more than the red, white, and blue, it meant more than all those things that people were talking about. And so I think, you know, Chet Blalock's one of those people that in my early impressions that I saw made a difference because he was ethical and he was honest and he was principled. There were people like Gene Turnage, who, as a freshman liberal legislator from Missoula, I went to him on several times with issues that I didn't understand or I wanted to work on. And he was the Republican president of the Senate, or he was the majority leader, and he was always a statesman to me. He was always kind, he was always courteous, and he was always professional. So he had a big impact on my understanding of a role of a leader, and whether it was Republican or Democrat. People like Francis Bardineau, who had been budget chairman but never sought other leadership positions. I remember him standing up during a Democratic caucus when everybody was talking about raising taxes or changing the budget or kicking the Republicans, you know, if we had a majority. And he would stand up and say, "You can't do this. You've got to have a longer term vision. If you do this, the people will unelect you." And in fact, that's exactly what happened. And for 14 years, the Democrats were in the minority. There were people like Stan Stevens on the Republican side, who I saw many times give very statesman-like speeches, not partisan speeches, but speeches that would, you know, that were reflective of how important the process of the legislature was to him, and not necessarily partisan on an issue, but something that I always held with me. There were leaders probably in terms of style like Fred Van Valkenburgh and John Mercer, who, you know, can be very aggressive leaders, in difference in style from Gene Turnage and Stan Stevens, and very articulate speakers, very articulate leaders in their positions, and able to take positions and principal positions and develop forceful positions that would bring people around to their position just because of the sheer force of their personality. And so there are people like that I think I listened to and I learned from in the early days that helped me learn the rules, it helped me learn the collegiality, it helped me learn the ability to compromise, it helped me, you know, learn how to be a leader. So, I mean, there were lots of different lessons being learned there, and I was trying to pay attention as much as possible.
Lobbyists.
There are certain eras that I remember more than others, and obviously the importance of the tobacco companies, the Montana power companies, the powerful tavern owners, lobbies. I mean, when you look at Gary Langley from the Montana Mining Association, Jim Mockler from the Coal Council, Buck Bowles from the Chamber of Commerce, Phil Strope, who lobbied tobacco and oil and gas, Jerome Anderson, who did those tobacco and oil and gas as well. I mean, these were old bulls themselves who'd been around for a long time that were, I think, very honest guys. I think they were straightforward. They would always be forceful in their positions, but they were the hard-driving, hard-drinking, and tough sons of guns that you would see out. Jim Murray from AFL-CIO, that you'd see him at Jorgensen's, and Jorgensen's is where you'd go most of the time to be able to really talk politics and potentially get some work done. But
Jorgensen's is a bar and restaurant near the Capitol building that was a sort of a watering hole and yes, melting pot for legislators.
It was. You know, and as a freshman legislator, I think Doc Norman was one of the Democratic leaders that warned me, you probably ought to watch yourself and maybe not go in there either at all or very often, because you potentially, you know, you could get in trouble in there just because there are a lot of free drinks bought in there and maybe even a free meal every now and then. But I also learned the lesson, too, that if you can't drink their whiskey and eat their food and still vote against them, that you didn't deserve to be in the legislature. And I saw, you know, many of my friends there who were able to do that. I mean, that lesson was that go ahead and get it all on the table, listen to the lobbyists and the, again, from John Lauer, the Montana Power Company, Gary Williams, Mike Bichette, I mean, very good lobbyists who worked with us, and became friends with them, and you could still vote no, and they still respected you for the position you took, as long as, you know, you respected their ability to be able to let their position get known.
Now, Mike, I think it's commonly understood that lobbyists have to be honest, lobbyists have to be they have to be well informed and understand the legislation that they're lobbying for or against. But there's some lobbyists who seem to be more effective than others. And my list would be similar to yours if I was to make a list. What do you think it is about some of those men that made them sort of in a league beyond the normal old garden variety lobbyist?
Well, I mean, I think you hit the first point, is the most important thing is they had to be honest. And if they lost that credibility, then they weren't credible with the legislature, whether Republican or Democrat. But I think they also, you know, had to be able to have a tremendous amount of tolerance, you know, inside them, and respect for legislators who were honest with them. And I think the effective lobbyist would come in, you'd know exactly, you know, who they lobbied for. They'd have all of the facts, they'd be able to research the facts, so they'd be able to at least give you the most articulate explanation of their position. And it was that you respected. Tell me what you stand for, tell me what you want, tell me what you're looking for, so I can decide whether I think that is a good change to public policy, or whether I need to meld that with other things I'm hearing from other lobbyists. And so I think effectiveness was that they respected you for the ability to be able to listen to them. If you took the time to listen to their opinions and you were respectful of them, I think they respected the fact that if you couldn't vote with them, or if you needed to amend what they were trying to do, or if you wanted to work on their issues and maybe it wasn't going to be this session, but you wanted to think about it, that they never ever got upset, never showed their anger, never showed the fact that they were even, you know, upset with you. And I think that more than anything else, that tolerance of your and respect of your ability to represent your district in the way that you thought was the best way possible.
Now, you became a member of the state senate at the same time Governor Ted Schwinden became governor.
Yes.
So for the full 8 years of Schwinden's administration, you were a member of the state senate, and you probably had numerous conversations with him. I assume you must have.
Yes.
What are your impressions of his, of Ted Schwinden, and do you have a story that might kind of typify Ted Schwinden and his leadership style?
Well, I think, you know, there were leaders at the time like Fred Van Valkenburg and Bill Norman and Chet Blalock and Greg Jurgensen who spent more time with Ted Schwinden. As a freshman, I was only on the sidelines with meetings for most of the 8 years while I was there, because all the older guys, the more senior members, were moving up into leadership positions. But I had I was impressed with Ted Swindon because he was not necessarily a Democrat or a Republican. I mean, I couldn't determine because he was a moderate fiscally. He seemed to be a moderate on some of the human and social service issues. He definitely was a moderate on education because he wouldn't give them all that they wanted. And I mean, I saw a guy who literally, I think, represented what he felt to be the public interest of Montana, not necessarily, you know, any part of the state or any constituency group. It was that he was going to do what was best for Montana. And the story, you know, that I would have is I went to him and talked to him about local governments. I thought that the closer that the decisions were made locally, that the better decisions they would be, and that the legislature ought to get out of the business of dealing with and telling local governments what to do. And Ted Swindon would have none of that. he said, you know, it's something where that local governments, if they have the ability to tax, we end up with a balkanized state with taxation and a mix that's a mosaic that just doesn't work for Montana. And their budgets will all be different if we allow them tremendous budget authority, that they'll raise property taxes, and you know, that's just not a responsible, you know, thing to do. And with regulations, you know, we are a different state between East and West, and if we allow them to adopt all their own regulations for water and environment and air and you name it, and gambling, and you know, that it just wouldn't work. And so, I mean, he put me in my place very quickly with respect to my wild-eyed idea about maybe adopting a home rule amendment to the Constitution to give local governments more control.
My experience with him was similar, too, though I probably saw less of him than you did, but he had great self-confidence. He wasn't a braggart, he wasn't a showman, but he could make a decision and look you in the eye and tell you what he thought, and you probably had the self-confidence to back down from it if you could talk him out of it, but he was also one of the smartest guys I ever knew.
Yeah.
And but I think from the Republican point of view, we regarded him as conservative, in some cases maybe more conservative than some of us.
That's right.
But he was somewhat of a partisan also.
Yeah.
He wasn't necessarily a liberal Democrat, but he was a fairly partisan Democrat in spite of his conservative tendencies, especially with money.
Yeah.
At least that was kind of our impression. Stevens, you've already commented about how he could give a good talk in the state Senate that wasn't particularly polarizing and that sort of thing. But then he became governor, and that's a different job, maybe requires different skills. What were your impressions of Stevens as governor?
In fact, I was very surprised at the way Governor Stevens surrounded himself with people, like-minded people, and he seemed to from the very get-go, from the appointment of all of his cabinet members to his inner staff, he seemed to distrust everything else that had gone on, that any employees potentially who had been in a deputy position in the executive branches, that sort of thing, that the statesman that I knew, kind of maybe he was being coached by people that he trusted to go a particular direction, but he just seemed to be able to be surrounding himself with people who were going to protect him and maybe take him in a direction that would move conservative values forward. But his inner circle just didn't seem to have the impact in the legislature because they seemed to close ranks rather than be as the statesman and the compromiser that he seemed to be in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was surprised at the way he started his administration, and he had some trouble with some of the appointments that fell apart because of some personal issues that they had. But from the get-go, he seemed to have distrust of the very legislature that he'd been part of for so many years. And as a great businessman, because he was a very, very good businessman, and you know, I think he wanted to run the state like a business, and it just doesn't work that way.
And maybe sometimes, too, it's easier to be an ideologue when you're one of 50 in the state Senate, though my impression of Stan as a senator, too, is the same as yours. I found him more ideological when he became governor than he was when he was a state senator, and I've never been quite sure how to account for that either. But Do you remember an incident? Do you remember an experience when you met with him while he was governor, when you had a visit with him in his office? Or
you know, my only, again, I was so new. I was only, I think, 83 or 87 that he was governor.
He was governor from 89 to 93.
89 to 93. That it was actually on a weekend on the golf course with J.D. Lynch and Alan Colstead, who would later be his lieutenant governor. And it was that first opportunity that I got a chance to actually get to know both Alan and Stan, you know, in a way that allowed me to be their friend for the rest of my time in the legislature and then beyond. But I don't have a particular story other than that Stan was a fundamentally, you know, statesman in his own right. And I think as a legislator, he was just a superb legislator, set a tremendous example, you know, for all legislators to follow. And then fell on a track while he was governor that just didn't seem to fit with his personality or his approach there, and I don't think that served him well as the chief executive.
Mark Roscoe.
I got to know Mark probably better than Stan Stevens, because as minority leader, I would have the weekly meetings with Mark, and I think he had a vision of the legislature. Actually, I think his impression of dealing with people was that he trusted people. There was this basic innate trust of people. And so in the legislature, I would hear about things that the more conservative Republicans wanted to do to the budget, whether cuts or to the tax structure or things like that. And he would be having, of course, conversations every day with his Republican colleagues. And during my meetings as minority leader with him, I would say, well, I'm hearing that certain things are happening, you know, to the budget. He said, no, I've already talked with my Republican leaders and things are going this way. And I said, no, I think you need to check on that, you know. But I think he was naive, even though I don't say that in a negative way at all. I think he wanted to trust people so much in their good nature that he didn't ever want to immerse himself in the politics of the mud, the blood, and the beer of the legislature. And he always stood above that, and even when he submitted bills, whether it was the sales tax or the deregulation, the thing that he supported, that he kept his hands off. He never did immerse himself in any of the internal debates that would go on in the legislature, and he kept his people away from that. So he had he was a moderate, and he was easy to work with. He was very much a gentleman and a statesman. But I think as they looked at his legacy, one of the issues was what is there that's of any substance here other than the fact that we've moved forward, we've got surpluses in the budget, things are stable, and there's a lot to be said for that. That Montanans just kind of supported this gentleman as a governor, and that he was just keeping things on an even keel and trying to make sure people felt welcome no matter who they were, Republican or Democrat. And I think there's a lot to be said for that approach toward, although it doesn't necessarily work in the legislative process.
Yeah.
It works to govern the rest of the state.
Now, Mike, you know, his moderation got him into some trouble with members of his own party who were critical of him, felt that he was too moderate. And there's a belief, and I'd just be curious to know if you know anything about this or if you were in on it, that the Democratic leaders in the legislature at some point during his administration promised to back him on vetoes because of concern that the Republicans would unite against the governor of their own party to override him. Can you shed any light on that? Do you remember anything about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know that I had to tell him on several occasions as we got near the end of the session that I knew certain bills were coming forward, whether they were budget bills or other bills that would affect the executive branch or state agencies, and that Democrats were very much opposed to those bills, and that we would support him, and I would stand up on the floor and support him, that we were going to make sure that if we could grab some Republican moderates, that we'd be able to overcome any or hopefully hold up his vetoes or prevent a veto from being overturned. So we definitely worked with him on that, and we on several occasions told him that we would unite in both the House and the Senate.
Do you remember anything beyond that? Like, was there a bill that was passed by the Republican legislature that got on his desk and he vetoed it and the Democrats sustained him? Right to Work would have been an example, but I don't remember if it ever got to his desk.
It never got to his desk, yeah. No, I mean, no. I can't remember a specific... I mean, Right to Work was always part of the mix in some of those value-based questions, but... most of them were budgetary, education-related, where he wanted to fund the university system at a certain level, and it was in the budget. And I remember telling him that I knew that the plan was, to take that money out of the budget. And he said, "No, Republican leaders have told me that it's good." And I said, "No, you need to check on that." And in fact, I was right. So I mean, we would stand up and try to give him the votes on the floor to protect whatever, and particularly in the conference committee in the final budget bill.
Do you remember ever working with Dave Lewis, who was Roscoe's budget director, on those kinds of issues?
Sure.
Any story or anything about that?
Well, again, I was always on taxation committee, so I didn't work with Dave until now that I'm a lobbyist myself. So, I mean, I just had a lot of respect for him just because of his knowledge of the budget process, but no, I don't.
So. Judy Martz.
I thought, as minority leader and a legislator, I mean, working with Governor Martz, it just seemed to me that her impression of Democrats were we were part of some camp that you, and I'm not using the right word there, that there was an inherent sense of partisanship, that an us versus them that seemed to permeate that administration. And so even if you walked up to the governor's receptionist and they knew that you were a Democrat, you did not feel welcome. And I don't think she wanted to convey that message at all, but I think there was this permeation of this aura, that she was going to bring state government back on track again and get pro-business, and we're going to, move Montana forward in a certain way, and everyone else better get out of the way. And, and I think she surrounded herself with people who reflected those values, and so she was difficult to work with in that sense.
Yeah.
That if you weren't with her, you were against her, and that's just not the way the legislative process works.
She was relatively inexperienced, of course, coming into the office of governor. You were never in the legislature while our current governor, Brian Schweitzer, was governor. Any thoughts or impressions on him?
Well,
you've been a lobbyist since he's been governor, so you might have some knowledge.
Well, I think my impression is that even though I don't believe Brian has the proper respect for the legislative process and its ability to deliberate through issues, I think he is a strong executive that has taken advantage of the fact that term limits have kept the legislature from being as effective as it, and so he's been able to really and manipulate's too strong a word, because I mean manipulate would be what you'd be able to do when you've got a body that isn't functioning correctly. And so Brian's been able to effectively run the state and push the legislature around during the time that he's been governor. He's a very strong personality, very, very intelligent man, and he's got people that understand that legislative process that work in his inner circle. And so I think he's someone that is a force to be reckoned with just because of the sheer force and dominance of his personality. And it doesn't work well with a legislature that is supposed to be an equal branch of government when he will make comments about the fact that they're out drinking whiskey or instead of doing their job. So I think he can be a lot more effective if he would spend a little more time understanding the legislative process.
Back before term limitations, when there were men in the Senate, Gene Turnage and Bill Mathers and Chet Blalock and so on, some pretty old, strong men, his leadership style might not have worked as well as it does now with this new era of term limitations. Would you agree?
I would totally agree. Yeah, there would be a tremendous pushback from the old guard. In fact, there was pushback against Schwinden when Schwinden wanted to do things potentially that were more moderate than the Democrats wanted. There was a big pushback by Democrats who would not give him what he wanted. And nowadays, the Democrats just seem to roll over and not want to buck the governor because they can't put together the coalitions to do what they want to do.
And many of them haven't been there for a long time. You know, they haven't maybe developed a firm sense of that they're competent in a particular area or something like that, where they think, well, I know as much about it as he does, maybe a heck of a lot more. I'm not going to get shoved around by him.
Right.
For people who are relative newcomers to the process, that's a pretty bold thought to have.
It is.
Yeah. Now I'm going to go back and just ask you to use two or three descriptive terms for each one. So if I said Ted Schwinden, what would the maybe two or three terms come to your mind?
Well, moderate, intense, agriculture. I mean, it's something that would... Because he had that roll down home, straight at you, shoot him straight approach. And so that's more than two or three words, I'm sorry.
Stevens.
Statesman. Respectful. Very articulate in his presentations. And a strong leader.
Roscoe.
As a former attorney general, always... knows his facts extremely well, very much a gentleman, very much a statesman, but not a guy who likes to get involved in details, particularly in public policy details.
Mertz.
Likes to, I think, govern from 40,000 feet, and has other people manage the details, is a very articulate spokesman for very conservative values that she represents very well, and partisan.
Schweitzer.
Strong personality, very intelligent, very partisan.
What legislation most stands out in your memory? Because you were there for 22 years, so I'm thinking there probably were, it might be maybe hard to know for sure, but there must have been two or three bills that kind of stand out in your memory.
Well, there are issues. Deregulation is by far and away the biggest, and I'm sure you've heard that before, and I did not vote for it, but it's the worst decision the legislature's made in the 100-plus years of our history. But other issues that I think are
Explain, just for some historian that might be listening to this tape in the future, just in a general way, tell about deregulation.
Well, the Montana Power Company that had an integrated system that owned the power source along with the power poles and the lines and the distribution systems, and so they actually owned through some other companies the actual coal and other things that would go into them. The power plants, but they saw the handwriting on the wall that they could not compete with the Enrons of the world and the larger utilities, and so they came to the legislature with a proposal to essentially deregulate the power plant portion, the power source of the utilities, the coal strips 1, 2, 3, and 4, as well as the dams that they own.
We say deregulation. Montana now has a public service commission that's elected by the people in the state. And prior to deregulation, and maybe to some extent even since deregulation, but certainly prior to deregulation, the regulated utility companies, such as the Montana Power Company and the Montana Dakota Utilities Company and Pacific Power and Light Company, had to go to the public service commission to get permission to raise their rates. And so deregulation basically cut them loose from that regulation process. At least that's how I understand it.
It did.
Yeah, okay. And so people, they could charge any rate they wanted to, provided they could be competitive in the free market.
That's right.
And the result was?
Well, the other part of that is that if they could value their assets based on what they would be able to sell the power for in the open market, their assets under a regulated system would be worth X, and the assets under a deregulated system would be worth 10 times that. And so for them to sell their assets, they had to have a deregulated system. And when the legislature finally dealt with that, we were the only state, or actually there were two or three other states at that time that were taking a look at deregulation, and I think a couple of them had actually passed it, although they had not, the bills had not gone into effect yet, and those states afterwards rescinded what they had done. And Montana ended up being the only state in the nation that adopted deregulation, and with, under the assumption that there would be competitive power. And then right after that passed, Enron went bankrupt, or it fell apart, and there was effectively no competition out there to be able to compete with the Montana Power Company. And so,
you said Enron. What was the connection?
Well, Enron was the literally the utility that was based, I think, in Texas, that was essentially buying power plants all over the country, or owned power plants, or that was providing power to, you know, it was one of the three or four biggest, you know, in the nation. And they, because their price for power was at 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour, Montana Power's was at around 3 cents a kilowatt hour, you know, so they were still competitive, but they saw that when they went out to bid on contracts to try to expand their business, they essentially, you know, couldn't compete against the Enrons of the world. So they needed to deregulate and sell the assets and get out of the regulated utility industry, or just get out of the power generation industry altogether.
And when the legislature deregulated Montana Power Company and the other utility companies in Montana, then in the case of Montana Power, as you mentioned, the value of the stock of the company rose considerably, because investors thought, well, now the Montana Power Company isn't restricted by the Public Service Commission that allows it to just have a minimal profit all the time, just allows it to stay in business all the time. So the stock wouldn't be as valuable as a company that could charge what the market would bear.
That's right.
So they sold out at this much higher price,
right,
as the result of deregulation, and then the price that was charged to Montana ratepayers or electricity consumers afterwards, when the monopoly was broken up, how did it work then?
Well, there was a safety valve in there that the power, that the rates could not change for 2 years to allow competition to potentially come into the state, to
okay,
allow the Montanans to be able to find a power source beyond the Montana Power Company. And so the stock essentially was stable, but they could still, you know, only 50% of the power they generated stayed in Montana. The rest of it went out of state. So they could still sell 50% of that power then out of state, and that's why their stock went up to $60 or whatever it ended up,
yeah,
being from $20 or $30 before. And so, but once
the Montana Power Company generated most of its own electricity.
Absolutely.
So they had a, you know, they were involved heavily in generation. They were involved in the transmission of electricity, and they were involved in the literal distribution to the meter on somebody's house. Well, then when they sold out, they sold the transmission part of it and the distribution part of it separately from the generation part of it.
Yes, they did. Yeah. Yeah. And
why is that important? I don't know if it is, but is it in terms of to the average Montanan?
Well, I think to the average Montanans, they didn't know. I guess it just, the overall issue for average Montanans was the fact that the utility power production source got sold. The powers, the utility lines, the poles and the wires really was a distribution system that could have been used by anybody. And
yeah,
so that didn't make much difference to the average consumer. It was the fact that we potentially, within 2 years of deregulation passing, are going to have to go out on the open market, just like you buy phone service, and try to find somebody to provide you power that would be at a competitive price. And prices, as we know, soared, and people were not able to find, you know, power, and there was no competition out there. So,
other bills or issues, the sales tax you've mentioned.
Well, the Godzilla, the Bruce Crippen Godzilla sales taxes. I think Bruce had two, maybe three, during the time that he was there, and because it was a huge plan, at least the Democrats felt that the Republican plan was to eviscerate the property tax system and eviscerate the income tax and other revenue sources for local governments as well as schools, and be able to then potentially have people in those constituencies come to the legislature and cry for a sales tax. And so Bruce, Senator Crippen out of Billings, had bills in that he called Godzilla 1 and Godzilla 2, you know, 3 and whatever, and we went through those hour after hour and attempting, and of course none of them ever passed, you know, the legislature to potentially go out, because all of them required a vote of the people. And one house or the other would end up killing the sales tax, because there would be an unholy coalition that would be put together. And that would be the Democrats, who wanted new revenue. If they didn't get new revenue, they would vote no on it. And the Republicans said, if there is new revenue, we won't vote for it. And both of them, I mean, the Republicans wanted property tax relief as a huge component of it. The Democrats could care less about that, but wouldn't support it. And so there were never the constituencies that would be able to put together to try to get that done.
Now, Mike, one sales tax proposal did get through the legislature and get on the ballot. Do you remember that? That was in 1992 when Dorothy Bradley and Mark Roscoe both supported a sales tax, although they were different kinds of sales taxes, as you've just mentioned. So the 1993 legislature, I think, attempted to try to kind of combine their two philosophies into one proposal, and they placed it on the ballot. Any thoughts or recollections about that? Were you involved in the...
You know, I was not, but I think the huge issue was, again, that schools and local governments and the human service community and the social service community saw the sales tax as an opportunity to potentially get new revenue into their programs, the education community in particular. And because there was, I think, 30 million of new revenue, I can't remember, it was very close to that, and that was a pittance compared to what all of them needed. And so there just wasn't the constituency to support, you know, the switch from, and then when you looked at, if you were a conservative Republican or even just the average taxpayer, and what you were paying in your property tax on your home, the reduction that was proposed in that sales tax bill was so minimal that you're going to be paying still high property taxes as well as an income tax on a family of 1, 2, 3, or 4. And so it was a bad sales tax bill and needed to die, but it was something that really set the tone for the fact that the public wasn't going to support a sales tax for the next probably 20, 25, 30 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. It's because of the bad taste in the mouth that came from that particular debate. But the other issues that came up were stream access, I think, that we put together that lasted until just this last session, yeah. And they just fixed up, tinkered with it a little bit. The workers' compensation, we voted to tax employers and employees to be able to handle the massive deficits that were there, and that was bipartisan in the way that was done. I think the business equipment tax, it was at 13% at some point, and now that's down to 3%. A lot of that was done with bipartisan votes. Those were big issues back in those days to try to generate some
economic
development, yeah. development in Montana. But the budget cuts, when Swindon came in, I think for two or three of his sessions, we had $200 million, $250 million deficits. And so I think it was Republicans and Democrats trying to work together to try to figure out where you cut the budget. And so it wasn't really spending, it was cutting. Mm-hmm. That it was my first experience in the legislature with Swindon, and working with watching him and the big business, I forget what they call the summits of leaders at the end of a session, where they all met at the governor's room down,
yeah.
with, I remember, Stevens and Turnage and Van Valkenburg and Doc Norman, or all those guys around the table, and trying to work out agreements in the last 3 or 4 days of the session. And I think, I don't know if it worked or not, I can't remember whether they were able to agree, because we ended up going back to Cox and probably doing more agreement there than we were able to do in front of the general public.
Yeah, and the television cameras.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And maybe the loss of the coal tax fights. The Republicans seemed to want to always get to that coal tax endowment, and the Democrats would never let them do it. And so whether it was under Stevens or Roscoe, I think there was always plans to try to get at that endowment, because we did have deficits. People thought this is time to use the rainy day fund, and Democrats said no, it's not. And there were huge fights about using that coal tax endowment, which I think is approaching now $1 billion
yeah.
in the state.
Is there a particular piece of legislation that you were involved with, either as the sponsor or you importantly were involved with it, that you are proudest of?
You know, it may seem odd to say this, but I was the sponsor of the seatbelt law. You know, okay. I think we've saved a lot of lives, and I've gotten a lot of criticism from people over the years for invading their privacy in their car, but as we know, it saves a lot of lives. And the other areas that because I was a family law attorney and I worked as a deputy county attorney doing child abuse, neglect, and juvenile justice and mental health commitments, those kind of things, I have changed, or I was the responsible party for moving those issues into the 21st century, and I think I'm most proudest of the fact that if you look at our family laws, if you look at the juvenile justice and the mental health laws and the crime victims laws and those kind of things, my fingerprints are all over those. And trying to help kids meet our constitutional obligation of giving kids the rights they deserve, which are in our Constitution, and then helping victims of crimes. I had the first crime victims bill that was ever passed. It was one of my bills. And so a lot of social service, kind of human service issues, but things that really meant a difference to constituencies that I represented and worked with all the time.
And you were always, I think, a member of the Judiciary Committee, weren't you, when you were in the State
Senate? Yes, I was, for 22 years.
And chaired it, I think, a time or two?
No, I did not ever chair. I chaired taxation a couple times, but there were always, because I chaired tax at the time when, you know, there was somebody else in line to do judiciary, whether it was Joe Mazurek or Bruce Crippen.
And then what was your other committee?
Well, I was on Ag, you know.
And no, I didn't know.
I was on Ag near the last, I think, two or three sessions I was on agriculture, because I wanted to learn more about that topic, and I loved it. And I was on Natural Resources Committee. I was on Local Government Committee. So, I mean, in the afternoon, I switched around a little bit just to give myself some diversity.
What was your greatest frustration?
That's a very good question. I was in the minority for 16 out of the 22 years I was there. And then one of those was tied in a session. And probably the greatest frustration would also be the greatest strength that helped me now. And that's, the frustration is when you have a good idea and you're in the minority and having the majority just ignore you. And too often, I think the leaders who aren't statesmen, you know, will not listen, you know, to the Democrat or the Republican that's in the minority.
Yeah.
And I think if you do that, you will gradually move yourself farther to the right or farther to the left and move yourself away from the middle that really will keep you elected for a longer period of time. And so the frustration would be that the majority party just, you know, refused to listen most of the time, you know, to any good idea that you might have.
But you also, I think, took the advice of Senators Boylan and Graham, and you did work with people on the Republican side. I mean, I'm speaking as one who knows you were.
Right. When I looked at the number of years,
you were one of the reasonable guys.
Well, when I looked at over the 22 years that I was there and all the bills that I submitted, and I submitted a lot of bills, that 61% of my bills passed during that entire time, even though the Republicans controlled most of the time I was there. And so that tells me that I found ways to work with the other side in tangible ways that would allow me to get my bills through. And so, I mean, one of the bills I didn't mention was this plain language in contracts now. So if you go buy a refrigerator or a stereo or anything over, or a car, and you look at that simple contract that tells you how much you're going to borrow and how much interest you're going to pay over that period of time and what your payments are going to be, I submitted it one session and the bankers killed it. I went back and said, listen, Chase Manhattan Bank in New York has a simple contract called plain language in contracts. We should just do that in Montana. Once I showed them that, the second session, but today, that if you go borrow any money, my bill is the reason why those contracts are so simple to read.
Well, good.
And it's so that's one of those long-lasting things. It's just kind of this under the current, under the radar.
And I think it's important, too. Before we go into the last question or questions in the interview, I'd like to explore with you your experiences in political campaigns. Now, Missoula was still somewhat competitive politically when you started running back in the 1980s. as we are conducting this interview, the Democratic Party has a huge advantage here in Missoula, and it probably had an advantage, too, for that matter, when you started running, but maybe not as great. Is there a political campaign for the state senate that stands out in your mind?
What, of mine?
Yeah.
My very first one, it was my second campaign. Oops. Yeah, just let that ring. Can you take it?
Hello. Well, I'm right in the middle of an interview with Mike Callaghan. I'll call you back in half an hour. Okay. So.
Yeah. I got appointed to the Senate in 1980, so I had to run 2 years later. In the middle of that, I also went to law school over at Gonzaga. And so I had been absent in my district for 9 months, and there had never been a story about it. And so I don't know why. I never did try to hide it. I was just over there. And so someone filed against me, you know, in the March of the filing deadline. When I was still over at Gonzaga, went to school till the end of May. And so the campaign that stands out is trying to drive back to Missoula on weekends, get my law studies done.
Was this in the primary?
Yes. No, this was in the general. Okay. So I still had to come back just to be able to campaign and show my presence and go to meetings and that sort of thing. And then just having my opponent identify at that time what I felt were just moderate issues in education or in human services or in the environment that he felt that I was an extremist, and there were, you know, some literature that went to the doors that made me, you know, look like somebody that I wasn't. And I guess all of us have had those kind of experiences in campaigns, and so when you are not used to the election process and not used to the campaigns where someone all of a sudden this literature shows up at the door, you think everybody reads it and you think everybody believes it. And so it's that shock, you know, that, but it, when I look at it today, it was innocuous stuff. It was stuff that really, you know, was just, you know, Halligan voted for four or five budget bills that spent a whole bunch of money, or Halligan voted for environmental things that are going to stop business. And whereas nowadays, I think the rhetoric has ramped up, you know, tenfold, and the articulation of negative comments about opponents is mine was innocent compared to what is there today. So my recollection of campaigns where they were always very tense, and the most amazing thing about it is no matter how hard you campaign, you never knew if you were going to win.
Yeah.
never knew.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that was the most amazing and interesting part of it is, you know, if the public says no, then I'll agree with that. But you just don't know until the vote's finally in.
Who was your opponent?
You know, it's Art, and I'm trying to remember his last name, and it's a long last name, and I will remember it in a few minutes. But then,
he was your first serious opponent when you were over at law school.
Right.
Other opponents?
There's Art, and then there's a guy, Kathy Ogren's husband then, and I can't remember.
Kathy Ogren's a prominent businesswoman here in Missoula.
Owns Bitterroot Motors.
Yeah.
And she's married to Mark, and I can't remember his last name. But he ran against me, and he had plenty of money. And I remember, you know, thinking, okay, well, I won pretty handily in my first election. That I can, you know, I'll do some work. And then all of a sudden, in September, when the World Series comes on, there's commercials by this Mark Hansen, I can't remember that name. And they're very good commercials, very well done. And he's running against me big. So I called the station. He spent about $5,000, which back in 1985, it was a lot of money. And so, I mean, that was my first experience at somebody trying to, you know, what I thought was buy an election or pour money into an election when I was, you know, just barely in the raising of money process. So I think what you articulated earlier is that Missoula is mostly Democratic, and no matter what he would do, my district was strong enough to be able to stay with me, even if I only raised a third or a half of what he raised.
Yeah.
But that scared the daylights, you know, out of me, you know, when I all of a sudden saw all the commercials come on during the playoffs as well as the World Series, you know, that you know, close to the election.
Because a lot of people do watch the World Series.
That's right. Yeah. I couldn't afford to buy a spot, you know, during the World Series, and he had bought, you know, five or six, you know, during those games. So,
now, Mike, you also ran for lieutenant governor in 1992.
Right.
Tell about that. Tell about how you came to be your party's nominee for lieutenant governor, and tell about the campaign.
This is really interesting. I'd gotten to know Dorothy Bradley just because of her work on lots of issues in the legislature, mostly environmental and human service, and she was budget committees, that sort of thing. And when she decided to run for governor, I didn't know her that well, and but we started talking during that legislative session, just in the hallways, or just, you know, in the House or in the Senate. When she would come over, I would go over there. And one evening, I went back to my desk, and there was a yellow sticky note on my Senate desk. It said, "No sweat, 7 a.m. And I had no idea what that meant. But it was right on top of something. It said, "No sweat, 7 a.m. It didn't have an initial bite or anything else. And so I went out to Jorgensen's that night and happened to run into Leo Berry. And Leo Berry, I didn't know, was heavily involved in helping Dorothy potentially run for governor.
Now, Leo Berry was a member, I think, of the Schwinnan administration.
Right, state lands.
Commissioner of state lands, well-known attorney in Helena, who was a sort of a semi-active insider in the Democratic Party, and a prominent lobbyist and attorney.
For the Burlington Northern,
railroad.
Yeah. Right. So I told him, I had a few drinks and would end up talking to Leo and said, "Leo, God, I got this odd message on my desk. Said, no sweat, 7 a.m. And he just kind of quietly said, "Oh, why don't you meet Dorothy there at the No Sweat Cafe in Helena, which is down on one of the streets on Last Chance Gulch, at 7 a.m.
If it had been some, no sweat doesn't necessarily mean, that didn't mean anything.
No, didn't mean, I'd never been there, never even heard of the cafe before.
Yeah.
And so, it happens chance, I mean, I run into Leo. If I had not run into Leo, I don't know whether the events would have occurred the way they did. But so I met Dorothy there.
You and Dorothy?
Just me and Dorothy. And so we had a chance.
And she left the sticky note on your...
Yeah, she had left the sticky note.
Well, what did she do? I mean...
Well, I think she assumed that maybe Leo had already talked to me. Some of her people had talked to me to make sure that I knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But nobody had. And so... So we had this wonderful discussion, and she actually broached the subject with me that she was considering me as a possible lieutenant governor candidate. And I said, "Well, I was flattered, and I would be honored, and, you know, and what else do you need to know?" And so we developed a dialogue and talked for a few weeks. And then after the end of the session, she called me and offered me the position, you know, to run with her. And I accepted immediately. I'd already talked to my wife. And my several memories from that are so positive are that we talked about my differences, for instance, on capital punishment or on business-related issues or railroads or whatever. And she said, "Mike, don't worry about that. You just simply tell the truth. That's the easiest way to do this, is you always tell the truth. If we have differences of opinion, then I'll end up making a decision one way or the other, because I'll be governor. And I welcome your opinion, even if it is different than mine." And so that, from the get-go, was a great way to start a campaign with someone, is being able to tell the truth. And secondly, was the respect that she had for her genuine way of running her own campaign, and that she would not give a political answer. If you asked her a question, no matter how controversial it was, and I think she got a question near the end of the campaign of whether she would commute Duncan McKenzie's sentence, and it was
Duncan McKenzie, a brutal, terrible murderer under the death sentence in the penitentiary.
That's right. It murdered a young teacher up in the High Line.
And her position had been that she was opposed to capital punishment.
That's right.
So then the news reporter or whoever said, "Okay, well, if you are, would you commute the death sentence of Duncan McKenzie, who everybody in Montana reviled as the most horrible..."
That's right.
Yeah.
And I don't. It wasn't actually a reporter. She was on one of the Northern Ag Network radio programs during the last weeks of the campaign.
So it was an answer to a caller's question.
Caller's question, which was a planted question.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Okay. So, and she answered, you know, I don't know. I'll have to look at the facts of that case to find out for sure. And that was the honest answer. That was the only answer she could give.
Yeah.
It wasn't a political answer. But that went like wildfire out there. And she was, I think, asked another question about whether the agriculture has too much influence on the Fish and Game Commission. And she said, you know, I don't know, but perhaps they do, you know, which went like wildfire out
through the ranch and farm community.
But she gave an honest answer. She didn't know, and she wanted to find out. And so, I mean, it was being with this genuine person. So if we lost that election, it wasn't because of any terrible things we did at all. It was because we were honest throughout that whole campaign and just simply told the truth in the best way we could. And if it didn't resonate with people, then that was it. But she treated my family with tremendous respect. We had, you know, we had two young kids at the time, and we always, they were very gracious no matter where we went. We had places to stay for the kids and everything else. So, I mean, I had a wonderful experience there, and there isn't a negative memory that I have during that campaign.
That's great. You tell one funny story that I think, or I've heard you tell this before, that I think occurred during that campaign. It was about a memorable flight in an airplane with Senator Cecil Weeding.
I have a very memorable flight.
Tell me about that.
the campaign wanted me to go to the Bucking Horse sale in Miles City. So, because Dorothy had to be somewhere else, I was supposed to go to Miles City and to the Bucking Horse sale. And they called up. Cecil Weeding had wanted to help out the campaign. Cecil was an old, wild and crazy rancher from Jordan, Montana. Great old guy. And not that old. He just looked like he'd been drugged behind a truck. You know, and was always having a bad hair day, you know. So I called Cecil at his ranch in Jordan, and he said, in his old voice, well, yeah, I'll bring her into Billings, you know, and she's a low wing, which I didn't even know what that was, you know, it's just where the wing isn't above the top of the fuselage or whatever. And I don't want to shut her off.
You're in Billings and you need to get up to Miles City and back in a hurry.
Yeah.
Cecil's a guy you knew in the state Senate. You understood he had an airplane.
That's right.
You called him up
and he volunteered it. And he says, I use her as a crop duster and everything else, so she's a bit dusty and everything else. If I shut her off, I'm afraid I won't be able to get her started again. So when I come into, I think, whatever the aviation is down there, place, you jump on. So I stayed outside that thing. I was supposed to meet him at like 7 in the morning, and sure enough, he lands in this old crop dusting plane, and I get in, and there is dust, at, you know, a quarter of an inch thick all over that airplane, side of that airplane. And we get in the airplane, I put the headset on, and he taxis out, and we take off, and he's flying west. And we're supposed to be going east. So finally, the tower. Literally, I'm listening to this on the headset. The tower called him up and goes, whatever his call sign was, we thought your flight plan showed you going east to Miles City. Oh, and Cecil, okay. So, I mean, he just had kind of, I don't know, maybe had a senior moment or something like that, but we were just flying west, and he decided, he turned it around. So we turn it around, we land in Miles City, we do the Bucking Horse sale, and then after that, we have to go up to Plentywood and do a big Democratic dinner up there. And so we did finish the Bucking Horse sale just in the evening and fly up there just before it's getting dark. And we barely hit that landing strip. It's a very small landing strip at Plentywood. And Cease didn't have the instruments to be able to turn on the lights in the airstrip. And so we just got there just before dark. So we do the fundraiser, and we get out about 10 o'clock at night. And it's darker than heck. There's clouds everywhere. It's not raining, but it's one of those darker than heck nights that you cannot see in, you know, in front of you. And so C says, well, I think we can get down the runway, you know, with what we, you know, where we came from. So I think I can make it down there. You know, I've got my headlights on my plane, and that'll get us down the runway. So we proceeded to get in the plane, and somehow, I mean, you could just barely see the pavement in front of you. But he gunned that thing, and we were up in the air, and you could not see anything else. I mean, it was just as dark as can be. And I'm like, I couldn't even see Cecil next to me. It was that dark, because except for the little dim lights that were in the plane. And we got up in that plane, and we got to about, 3,000 feet or so, and all of a sudden the lights went out completely in that aircraft. And we'd already passed the Fort Peck Reservoir that had the lights on it so you could see where that was, and we were headed over that vast, I think, designated primitive area in which there is not a light for 30,000, 40,000 acres.
Yeah.
You know, and so it is dark, and you cannot see a thing, and so, you know, I'm freaking out, and so what do we do? So I says, Assis, what do you want me to do? Have you got a flashlight? And he says, well, I don't know. Why don't you check in the back? So I took my headset off, and I jumped in the back. Dust is flying everywhere. And so I'm searching all over the back, and lo and behold, I find a flashlight. It takes me 10, 15 minutes of climbing all over the place. And I get back over there, and I give him the flashlight, and he's starting to work on the dials, and he's got the flashlight, and it actually worked. I can't believe the flashlight worked after all that dust was in there. And as he's shining the flashlight on the instruments, I said, Cease, I'm feeling some stuff over here near my legs. I'm wondering if you could shine that flashlight over in my way. You know, so he shined it over, and I had about 6 mice on my right and left thighs that had climbed up my legs and were on my thighs. And then there were...
They climbed up inside your pants legs?
No, a couple on top. They were all on top of my pants legs. And there were a bunch down on my ankle. There were probably 10 more mice down in the cockpit, and
that you disrupted probably.
Absolutely. And what we didn't know was that the mice had chewed through the wiring on all of the instruments, and so none of them worked properly. Here he is trying to adjust them, and none of them worked right. So he realized that when the compass wouldn't go where it needed to go, and so we thought, all right, now what do? We're up in the air, we're at 5,000 feet, we can't see anything, there's barely even like a farm light every once in a while, it's darker than heck. So finally we're flying, and we must have flown for a half an hour like that, thinking we were going in a particular direction toward Billings, when, you know, we really weren't. So finally I saw, way off in the distance, a pulsing of a light, like a strobe, but it was way off of the curvature of the earth. And I said, Cease, just fly toward that thing. You know, that's the only thing we know of. So he says, well, let's give it a try. And so we flew, and it took us almost 45 minutes to get to where that strobe was. As we got closer and closer, the sky kind of lifted a bit. The moon actually came out, and as we came toward that strobe, we could see the Yellowstone River. The moon reflected off the Yellowstone River down below.
So you were more or less going in the right direction.
Yeah, but we were near Forsyth. We were south of Billings quite a ways, and so because we went toward Colstrip, where the strobe was. So C says, "Hey, I know where I'm at now." So we just followed the Yellowstone River at about 1,000 feet, you know, all the way back to Billings. He landed that plane in Billings at 1 o'clock in the morning, and fueled up and made it back to his ranch, and landed somehow on his farm, you know, without the instruments working. I don't know how he did that. And then he was later killed in a plane wreck where he ran his plane into a mountain.
Same plane,
you know. But, I mean, I was never real scared. It was just one of those, the mice got my attention, you know. But it was one of those things that you'd never experience. And Dorothy actually
Dorothy what?
Well, I mean, she, when I told her that story about seeing the Yellowstone, having the moon come up over the Yellowstone and then flying it back to Billings, that it was the anchor to get us home, Bill Bradley actually wrote a book, Senator Bill Bradley, and part of that story is in the foreword of that book about, you know, somebody, a wayward, you know, traveler, you know, in an airplane, and not really mentioning my name or Cecil's or anything else, but the fact that the moon came up and it reflected on the Yellowstone. We followed the Yellowstone home, you know, I mean.
So Dorothy Bradley told Bill Bradley that story?
She did. And he used it in the foreword of his book, you know, so. Now, I've never seen the book, so I'm going to have to sometime find, you know, in Dorothy's library, that book, so I can read the foreword and just see how much it connects with that full experience.
Now, Mike, what I remember, one of the things I remember about the campaign between Mark Roscoe and Dorothy Bradley in 1992 was that they had some phenomenal number of debates. They debated 30 or 40 times or something like that. The candidate running for lieutenant governor with Roscoe was current Congressman Denny Rehberg. Did you and Rehberg ever debate?
We debated a couple times, one in Great Falls and I believe once in Billings or once in Helena. And you know, I mean, Dennis was an aggressive campaigner. Denny or Dennis aggressive campaigner, but he was a soundbite guy, and he could do soundbites much better than I could. And so when it came to talking about that he was for jobs and natural resource development and this and that, I would get immersed into the details and I'd lose the crowd in 2 minutes, and he I think did a much better job on the campaign trail just being able to articulate the broader values, whereas I was too much into the details. But I mean, we got along well, and still get along well as he's congressman. But he followed the path that I would have liked to have followed. If I'd have been a lieutenant governor, I would have liked to have run for Congress or for Senate. And so I congratulate him for what he's done, on that.
Should just maybe mention one thing. Bill Bradley, who we commented about before, has no Montana connection, but was a U.S. Senator from New Jersey and ran at least once for his party's nomination for president.
Yep. Former NBA basketball player.
Former NBA basketball champion, too. And I think Rhodes Scholar, mm-hmm. I believe. Mike, just to kind of wind up our interview, historically, how do you think that the era in which you served in the legislature will be remembered, and why?
Well, I think, first and foremost, I think it'll be remembered as an era of statesmanship, where it was the last time that you would have the average years of service in the legislature be 15 to 20 years. And even though there was always turnover of probably 20 to 25% every time, but there were always those long time serving legislators that you could have as mentors, you could learn from, etc. And I think even though there were certainly some issues passed later on, like deregulation that shouldn't have happened, but I think that era, when you look at the deep friendships that were made, the collegiality, the fraternal nature of it, that it was a time when people had a lot of respect for people's opinions, and they didn't necessarily think that their opinion, their agenda, was something that needs to be adopted for all of Montana. They would automatically assume you'd roll out that issue and just find out, what the public thinks of it, and let the process work. I think there was a respect for the legislative process that doesn't exist today, and that was the integrity of a process that was deliberative. It allowed for transparency on its own. It didn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a word in vogue back in those days, but I think it was an era that I think people. Because of the friendships that you generated, there was more respect for people's opinion, and there was more natural compromises that came out of it. And I think that's what it'll be known for.
But because you can contrast it with how it changed, I think that memory's right. Even more vivid,
Yeah.
Because I think you were there more than me in a period of transition. I started my service in the legislature in 1971, and I finished in 1995. And I think there was, I remember the last 2 years that I served in the state Senate, I received more angry letters, more, I suppose, telephone calls, I can't remember that for sure, and felt a great deal more like a controversial figure than I had in the 24 preceding years. So I think that the change started in about 1994. When it was significant, and then term limitations just really pounded it in. When term limitations took effect in 2000, mm-hmm. then beginning in the 2001 session, I think the legislature was a very different creature than it right. was in the 1991 legislature 10 years before.
Right, and I think that in the old days, compromise was viewed as a leadership strategy, not a sign of weakness. And I think today, compromise, why should I compromise? I brought a bill, you ought to agree with the bill. If you don't, I'm going to, you were the problem. It's not me, it's somebody else who needed to compromise and not me. And I guess I just see that lack of long-term vision as being the biggest deficit there. And I mean, I think Mike Mansfield has the quote that a politician looks at the next election while a statesman looks at the next generation. And I think that quote, more than anything else, reflected that era that we served in, And now it's, even though I'm sure that they're trying real hard, but just because of the fact that they're only there for 8 years, they have a tendency to act like politicians rather than statesmen.
Yeah. Anything else in conclusion?
Well, one of the important lessons that I learned that I didn't expect to learn was when there were bills in to reduce the size of the legislature or to dilute the rural vote, I learned after a period of time, and it took probably a decade to do this, how important that rural voice was in the legislature. And I, you know, as the population gradually became more urbanized, they were losing population anyway, and reapportionment was going to take more of their voice away anyway, because there'd be less legislators from rural communities. But I remember standing up in, and people expected me as an urban legislator from Missoula to support a change in the Constitution that would reduce the number of Senate districts, or some bill that somebody had in back in the 80s. You know, and I got up and opposed that bill vehemently, just because the Jerry Devlins of the world and the Carol Grahams of the world, all the senators that were from those rural areas that I thought contributed so much in terms of just their institutional memory and just their vision of what we're Montana, where the balance is in public policy, that if you just had a bunch of urban people doing public policy, it would look a lot different rather and wouldn't be as balanced. And so there were lessons that I learned there that I didn't think I would come away with, and I think I'm a better human being because of that.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thanks for your public service.
Sure. Happy to do it. I don't know.